could say first name, last name, basic introductory information.
Jennifer Chase. I'm the managing director of Microsoft Research New England and Microsoft Research New York City. These are labs which are devoted to research in mathematics, computer science, the social sciences.
And then if you could spell your first name.
Jennifer, J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R, Chase, C-H-A-Y-E-S.
Well, thank you very much. And so we're going to be talking about a network specifically, you know, the networks related to medical science, which I just heard you give a wonderful talk about. But before we do that, let's talk just a little bit about what networks really are. And we might want to start, you know, somewhere with this networks that people are, say, rather comfortable with these days. So if you could tell me what networks are, and maybe tell me a little bit about, like an example, say, a social network example that would be, you know, nice and relatable.
Okay, so networks are, networks have nodes and they have edges, just like a graph. The nodes could, for example, be people, and the edges could, for example, be friendships. So we could be talking about the Facebook network, which, as many of us know, has over a billion nodes now. We could be talking about a physical network like the internet, or we could be talking about something like the World Wide Web, where the nodes are web pages and the edges are hyperlinks. So we all deal with many, many networks.
And what are some of the, I mean, from a higher level sort of perspective, what are some of the reasons or that you would study a network or things that you can do once you have sort of identified the networks?
Well, much of the world is mediated by networks these days. So if we want to learn about the world, we sometimes get indirect information on these networks, and the more we understand about the networks, the more we can infer the information that we don't see, which might be really important to us. Also, there are networks on which we might want to devise some kind of algorithm to figure out something that we really care about, like we might be looking at the World Wide Web and ask, how do I do rankings so that I can search for certain things on the World Wide Web? If I understand the World Wide Web and I understand some mathematics, then I can actually figure out how to search the web.
And so then let's move in a little bit more towards some of the biological things. Now, before we get to the gene regulatory networks, you've done some work with spreads of epidemics on networks. And so that sort of, and that makes a high level bit of sense because, as you said, it can be a social network, it can be friendships, and one of the easy ways to have an epidemic is spread between people who know each other. So can you tell me a little bit about the work modeling epidemics when they're on networks?
So we looked at epidemics on networks, and in particular, we looked at epidemics on the kinds of networks that human beings have with each other, which are these networks with very long tails. So there are some hubs in these networks, some people who interact with many, many other people. It's not like people are on a grid and they all have the same number of neighbors. Some are very highly connected, some less so. And so if you look at how an epidemic spreads, it depends very much on the nature of the network. If I looked at the spread of a network on a grid on which everybody had four neighbors, it wouldn't spread that quickly, actually. It would be pretty easy to kill it off. On the other hand, if I look at the spread of an epidemic on what are called these scale-free graphs, these power law networks, which are a lot like human interactions, even a very small probability of spread from one person to another can lead to an out-of-control epidemic, because what can happen is that the disease can hit some hub that's very highly connected. And if you look at the mathematics, what happens is that then that hub lands up infecting some of its neighbors. It gets better, but it can get reinfected with some variant of the disease. And so it's almost like a light blinking on and off in the center. So that's what the mathematics says. And the implication of that is that we get really severe epidemics. And we saw fear of this with the SARS epidemic, with the Ebola epidemic. These are really, this really has to do with the fact that human beings interact on what I would call power law graphs, scale-free graphs.
And so if you had, say, an antidote for this, can the networks help you determine the best way to, or best sort of protocol to administer that to a group of people?
So, one of the questions that we studied is, if I had a fixed amount of antidote, how would I try to distribute that antidote to control the epidemic or to minimize the probability that I would ever have an epidemic? And it's interesting because one of the first things we thought about was really complicated, called contact tracing, which is done sometimes where once you're sick, they ask you about all of your neighbors, and then they try and go and inoculate or give antidote to every one of your neighbors or everybody you've interacted with. And so you would think that would be good. It's very complicated because you have to follow each person. It turns out that that will not control an epidemic on a power law network, but something easier will. If you go to the highest degree nodes and you give them enough doses of antidote in advance, it's kind of like if you wait until you have to do contact tracing, you know, the barn door is open and the epidemic is out. Whereas if you, in a preemptive fashion, give enough doses of epidemic or give an inoculation to the very high degree nodes, then you're really going to be able to control the epidemic much better. And we were able to prove that on a very wide variety of graphs.
And so then let's move on to the gene regulatory networks. Now, first up, I'm definitely going to need a definition for what a gene regulatory network is.
So there's the standard dogma, which is that the DNA in your cells is transcribed to RNA, and the RNA is transcribed to proteins. And, you know, the proteins mediate much of what happens in our cells. Different proteins are present in different amounts in different cells. In fact, during development, what happens is that certain parts of the DNA get shut down in different cells, and that's why our cells are different from each other. And within a given cell, what will happen is that after certain proteins are transcribed, they will go and they will sit on the DNA, on the chromosome, on the DNA, and they will cause certain parts of it to be transcribed more quickly or more slowly. And so you have a feedback mechanism. When it's more slowly, it's negative feedback. When it's more quickly, it's positive feedback. And you get what's often called a protein interactome, where you have these feedback mechanisms. And those are the things that keep a lot of our metabolism, a lot of our biological processes in check.
And then one of the things that, oh, I know I have this written down. one of the things that you mention a lot, like, are these, what is it, the protein pathway? I can understand most of the mathematics that you talked about. The biology was a little bit above the classes that I have taken. So I was wondering if you could explain what you meant by the protein pathway a little bit more, so I can get more of a grounding.
So an example might be a lot of these pathways start actually at the cell membrane. So you might have a protein which is sitting in the cell membrane that could be activated by some other proteins that are released, let's say a neuron. Okay, there's something going, you know, something fires in your brain and it goes down into part. So what happens is that will attach to the protein that's sitting in the membrane, and it will set off a cascade within the cell. So that will interact with another protein, which will interact with another protein, and you get things which look like cascades. But then the result of part of that cascade could be a protein which then goes and sits on DNA and tells that DNA to produce more or less of some other protein.
Okay, and so if we're looking at that from sort of a mathematical perspective, does that end up essentially looking like a network?
It looks very much like a network. It's a directed network. In fact, it's pretty complicated because it also has a temporal component to it, which we often don't model in the crudest models. So we're not capturing all aspects of the network, but we're capturing part of it by saying that the proteins themselves or the underlying genes, which are transcribed to those proteins, are the vertices, the nodes of that network, and the interactions between proteins are the edges of that network.
So biology is really complex, like living things in general are really complex. So I assume that it would be really hard to just go out and just watch these pathways happen, especially, you know, really tiny and there's a lot of things. So how do you go about building up these pathway networks?
So one of the things about biology is that we only observe a small part of what's going on. And from that, we want to look out over everything that is consistent with the part that we observe and say, what is, of all the things that we can imagine that are consistent with the part that we observe, what is most likely given the measurements that we have made? So that's why I view it as a combinatorial optimization program. What I'm trying to do is fit the little bit that I've seen with the possibilities over everything consistent with that and find the one that's most likely or the few that are most likely and then look at those and start to test those, make predictions from those. If, you know, network number one is the most likely, what would that predict? If network number two is the second to most likely, what would that predict? And then go and see which of these predictions turns out to be true.
And so you're doing it, but you actually end up building out these actual networks, which involve some mathematics that might be kind of hard to put down on audio and make them really clear. But I'd like to give a bit of a try to it. So when you're building out, you use something I believe called Steiner trees and Steiner forests. So if we could at least give a bit of a try to giving an explanation of how you are going about building out these networks.
So the Steiner tree problem is kind of a cool problem. What it says is that just on an abstract level, you know, let's say I have 1,000 possible vertices. I might be thinking of these later as genes or the proteins that are made from those genes. But let's just say 1,000 possible vertices. And let's say I really believe that 30 of them must be in the subnetwork that's important in a particular process in a cell.
So just to break in for a second, so those are essentially the ones that say we would know from observation in a biological sense, like we know that these are the ones that we have seen for sure are involved.
Yes, these are the ones that we see there. They are sitting at a much higher level in that process than in most processes, or in a much lower level. So we say, oh, these are way off from their background level. They're probably important. But we also know that these 30 proteins don't interact directly with each other. So there must be intermediate ones which are mediating this. So how do we find those intermediate ones which are mediating this? And okay, well, one thing to do is to look at how many of these are themselves sitting at some slightly elevated levels. But another thing to do is to say how many of these are known to interact with those 30. And of the ones that seem to interact strongly with those 30, how many other proteins interact with those that interact strongly with the 30? And from this, we start to build up a possible network that could be the real underlying network with the mediating proteins that we're not seeing directly, but that emerge when we consider all possible subnetworks that might be consistent with what we observe.
And so you have done this. if you hadn't, we probably wouldn't actually be talking about it, would we? And so one of the times you, or actually, no, before we actually talk about doing, this is super multidisciplinary. I mean, there's like very nice, pure, wonderful mathematics, and there's also clearly biology and network science, for those of you who don't know, is a discipline that is, I've never quite figured out why, but really dominated by physicists, or at least there are a lot of physicists involved. So how did you end up getting to a point where, like, I mean, not to say anything bad about mathematicians, but sometimes it can be insular. They love their discipline for a good reason. So how did you get to the point where you were working with all of these different areas and bringing it all together?
I personally love interdisciplinary work. My undergraduate degree was in biology. My graduate degree was in physics. I was a professor of mathematics. I then moved to run a computer science group when I knew nothing about computer science. Then I started doing some economics and social science. So I really like the connections among fields. I think that what happens is that you have very smart people in a given field who realize really deep things. And then if you learn about those, you can take those to another field and you can look really smart yourself. So, so I think taking insights from one field and bringing them to another can actually be very productive and very fun. So for me, I tend to do this. I tend to move from field to field. I find it most exciting when I can take something from a field that I know well, like mathematics or physics, to a different field, like biology or social science, and be able to come up with useful conclusions that people hadn't been able to reach through the known methods of that field. So for me, this is nirvana.
So let's go on to one of the ones you you used this method to model yeasts. So what were you looking at in that yeast? And then after you had the model, what was that next step that you took? Because having a model is great, but when you're doing interdisciplinary work, for sure, you always actually make that next step to seeing what that model actually says.
So one of the reasons that we looked at yeast is because there's so much data on it. The data is all publicly available, very well studied. So when we came up with this idea of applying the Steiner tree and our new algorithms for the Steiner tree to biology, yeast was a very natural one to look at. We were able to find the data. And then using that data, we were able to make predictions about what proteins that were not known to participate in the pheromone response pathway, which is what we were looking at, might actually be operative, might actually be important there. So we took this data that we could find online, we did the analysis, and then we had a prediction. But when you have a prediction, you know, you need to test that prediction. And in biology, you need to test it experimentally. So we had to find biologists who were actually willing to believe us enough to go and do the test.
And so you went in to these biologists. You said, we're pretty sure that this protein or gene is involved in this pathway, even though no one else necessarily thinks that. And so you had them run the test. And what did the test observe?
The test observed that when they knocked out that gene, that response pathway fell apart, which is, you know, which really said that it was involved, you know, which is very exciting to us because it was kind of experimental proof. I'm used to doing mathematical proofs. This was experimental proof that what we were doing was actually saying something about the biology.
And so you then, I'm sure, moved on to do more than just this one thing, but you then moved on to look at cancer. Specifically glioblastoma, which I had not heard of before today, but am now terribly frightened of. Could you tell me a little bit about what glioblastoma is?
Well, you probably have heard of it and just not realized it. Ted Kennedy died of glioblastoma. So, and you may recall that when it was found out that he had glioblastoma, everybody was so upset. The reason they were upset is because the prognosis is really poor. You know, there are about 10,000 cases a year. and to, you know, many fewer cases than lung cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, but the prognosis is so poor for glioblastoma. Also, I imagine one of the reasons that you're terrified is because it's so much more common in men than in women. But given how serious the disease is and that most people who are diagnosed have to go into a lot of treatment, we actually have a lot of information on glioblastoma. The people who have it, the people who have this brain cancer, you know, usually are operated on, so they actually take a tumor out of the brain and they can study that tumor, and the people are really closely monitored. So we know a lot about it.
And so you did similar work in trying to determine the pathway for the creation of the tumor is, So saying the pathway for the creation of the tumor, and this is when you brought something up in the talk that was very interesting to me, and that is, I mean, so you can create this optimal Steiner tree, but the life, the character in Jurassic Park, life will find a way, and so it's not just one pathway, is it? Like there's multiple ones. So how do you deal with the cases where it's not necessarily just that one optimal pathway that can do something biologically?
I think as we look at human cancers, we find that many things have to go wrong simultaneously for us to get cancer. Okay, we are pretty well designed. We've evolved very, very well. And so we have multiple pathways which keep various processes in check, and there have to be multiple dysfunctions which coincide in particular ways for us to develop cancer. One thing after another does not compensate, and then we develop cancer. So when we look at the glioblastoma pathway that emerges from the Steiner tree problem, it has many parts to it which make a lot of sense to any biologist, certainly to any oncologist, because they're pieces of the pathway which they see operating in many cancers. Okay, DNA damage repair is not done properly, or P57, which is operative in dysfunction of which is operative in many cancers. So the question was, what are the parts of this network that we found which are not already known? What are the things that are going wrong, you know, just in glioblastoma? And so that was what we focused on.
And so with glioblastoma, was there one that really stuck out that was, you know, kind of maybe not necessarily unexpected, but important?
Right. So what the Frankl lab found was that the really surprisingly, there was a central node in this network that emerged that didn't seem to make a lot of sense, that nobody had ever implicated in glioblastoma before, and that was the estrogen receptor, you know, which just seems like a weird thing. But of course, an estrogen receptor is going to have a very different role in men than in women. So it was kind of very exciting to see this because it was the first pathway link between glioblastoma and gender.
And what would the implications, what are potential implications of this from, say, a treatment perspective?
Well, I'm not sure how to get estrogen into the brain, but in vitro, not in vivo, if you have glioblastoma cells and you put in a certain kind of inhibitor for something called EGFR, which is a receptor, membrane receptor, with or without estrogen, with estrogen, the cells die much more quickly. The glioblastoma cells die much more quickly. So estrogen does seem to have an effect in the form of estradiol, a particular kind of estrogen, does seem to have a negative effect on glioblastoma. If estrogen has a negative effect, it makes some sense. You know, women have a lot more estrogen floating around in them than men do. And although it's not clear how estrogen would get to the brain, We don't understand fully how glioblastoma operates anyway. We see it in the brain, but we're not sure how it operates. But this is promising because it means that the estrogen receptor, maybe estrogen itself, could be a target.
And then the last thing that you talked about is something that makes sense, because one thing that I keep on harping on is that life is very complex. And so cancers are very different from person to person, and also, of course, cancer to cancer. It's one reason that the idea of a cure for cancer is an odd thing, because it's not one disease. And so you worked a bit on doing patient-specific network analysis. And so what was one of the things that you saw when you, how did you sort of go about that? So what was your process? I mean, of course, you could do it in the same way for a patient, but once you had multiple patients, what was the step after that?
So we did the same kind of analysis that we had done in general for each different patient. And for each different patient, we found certain pathways, certain groups of pathways, and we found certain specific proteins that were implicated. And then we clustered the patients. And, you know, as we know, in breast cancer, for example, there are some patients where tamoxifen helps a great deal, and there are others for whom it doesn't help. Those are probably different cancers. And we don't have that many tries to get the treatment right before cancer metastasizes. So it's very important to understand that there are these different clusters. And so we took the pathways that we derived for each patient and we clustered them. And then we used information that we had learned from all the different clusters to update each of them, and did this in an iterative way, which not only at the end gave us patient-specific information, but also allowed us to use insights gained from one cluster to help us understand the other cluster. Not that they would have the same therapies, but there may be some of the same underlying causes. So this allowed us to really hone the treatment, the patient-specific treatment for each cluster. And I think it's very important. Years from now, we are not going to believe that we talked about breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, because each of these is multiple diseases, and there is not only one treatment. There are many treatments, and it's very important to get the first line treatment to be the right one for your particular kind of cancer.
What were you looking at when you're doing the patient-specific work? Were you looking at multiple cancers? Were you looking at a very specific cancer? Was it still glioblastoma?
We were looking for the patient-specific work. We were looking at breast cancer. We were using what's called the Cancer Genome Atlas, TCGA, which is a multi-institutional data set for about 20 different kinds of cancer. The NIH encouraged different institutions to get together and pool their cancer data on about 20 different kinds of cancer. So in looking at TCGA for breast cancer, we were looking at breast cancer patients from many, many different hospitals, many institutions. They're very large data sets, and they allow much more detailed analyses.
Now, network science has existed in this kind of current form since around 99 or so. So this is still a very young young area, and so all of this research is very cutting edge, very, very new and very interesting. I was wondering if you had any sort of insights, you're running a couple of research labs of kind of like what might be coming down the line, like where might we be seeing this sort of work go next?
Well, I think we're going to see network science applied a lot, because we're starting to get a lot more data. And the data that we're getting in many different fields is actually network or graphical data. That's the appropriate data structure. One area that I think is really about to take off is neuroscience, because we're finally able to get enough data in neuroscience. And I'm very excited because I think there's been relatively little advance in neuroscience so far. You know, we have the same psychiatric drugs we had couple of decades ago. We don't have good treatment for schizophrenia. We don't understand what causes autism. You know, there are many serious, serious diseases that are neurological in nature, and yet we have known so little about neuroscience. We don't yet know what are the types of neurons we have in our brain. In the rest of our body, we have 200 different cells. We have no idea how many types of neurons we have or what they are. So in the Obama Brain Project, question number one is what are the types of neurons? We are starting through things like network analysis to get information on this. So we're taking the first baby steps, but it's really going to take off. And I think we're going to get a lot of insights about neurological diseases, also about things like Alzheimer's, which, you know, if we manage to get rid of these other diseases, many of us will get hit with Alzheimer's.
So is there something that I should have asked you about this, but I just completely missed?
No, I don't think so. I think this has been a pretty good conversation.
Okay, give me just 30 seconds for a room tone. Always the most awkward part of the interview.
Okay.
So thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.